Welcome back to the program. The United States has long shared a very special relationship with Great Britain. Tony Blair, in his new memoir, talks about his synchronous and special relationship with Bill Clinton and his more macabre relationship with George W. Bush. In the 1980s, the policies of the U.S. were influenced by Ronald Reagan's special relationship with Margaret Thatcher. Both in domestic and foreign policy, Reagan's infatuation with Thatcher and her ideas shaped the U.S. and the world for years to come. Margaret Thatcher was both a pivotal and a polarizing leader in the 1980s. She inherited a country that was severely broken and reshaped it in her image. We're going to take a closer look at Margaret Thatcher this morning and her ideas and leadership as we're joined by my guest Claire Berlinski. She holds a doctorate in international relations at Oxford University. She's a contributing editor of City Journal. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. It is my pleasure to have Claire Berlinski here to talk about her new book, There Is No Alternative, Why Margaret Thatcher Matters. Claire, thanks so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
Great to have you here. One of the things that comes across so powerfully in looking at this is that Thatcher's influence was both domestic in terms of Great Britain and international, and in fact, her influence is lasting in both areas.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important. And a couple points related to that. The first thing is that Thatcher was one of the great Cold Warriors, and her influence in rolling back not just the Soviet Union, but all of the satellite states and all the entire international ideology of communism, which, it should be remembered, the time she came to power was still considered not only something to be taken seriously, but ascendant on the rise was very profound. But then also the example she set of rolling back socialism domestically in Britain was emulated around the world. Around the world, people looked at Britain and said, you know, she got rid of socialism there. Why do we have to live with it? It's possible. It's not inevitable. Look, it's not where all of history is pointing. You can roll it back. She did it, and Britain's better off for it.
When one looks at the forces that were coming together in Britain that allowed for Thatcher's ideas with respect to bringing about the end of socialism to take root, and the international scene and what was happening with the former Soviet Union and communism, to what extent was Thatcher an accident of history, or to what extent did she influence those events? And more specifically, her ability to grasp the forces that were playing out both at home and abroad.
They would have been dealing with the same forces. Whether they would have had the same reaction to it, I very much doubt. I mean, Thatcher was alone when she took charge of the Conservative Party in saying that the Conservative Party had to stand firm on certain issues in the way that she proposed they did. That's why she ran against the other... You know, she stood for the leadership of the Conservative Party against not only Ted Heath, but also any number of conservative politicians who said we need to take a pragmatic middle path, we need to be accommodating. And she was alone in saying, no, I stand for something different. You know the famous story, which I talk about in my book, about the gathering of conservatives at a Tory party conference in which some bureaucrat was going on and on about how the conservatives needed to take a pragmatic middle path, and Thatcher reached into her handbag. She pulled out a copy of the Constitution of Liberty, and she slammed it on the table, and she said, no. This is what we believe. So she was really unique among politicians in Britain. Now,
talk a little bit about Thatcher's rise, how she came to that place from very working class, middle class background.
She came from a lower middle class background. And this is very, very important to consider in the British context, because the British class structure was, and I think still remains to a large extent, much more fixed and rigid than the American class structure. And the amount of snobbery that she confronted because of the background she came from was quite considerable. She grew up helping her father in his grocery, you know, weighing flour and measuring dry goods and interacting with customers and counting change. And she made a great deal of this politically, so she was able to say very successfully, I understand exactly what it means to run a small business and what ordinary people are concerned about, in a much more successfully than someone who hadn't come from that background. And I think it did really influence her precisely that way. But it was also revolutionary to have someone who not only was from that background, but a woman as a leader of the Conservative Party and as the Prime Minister of Britain. And this is something that had not happened before. And her ability to make the most of her class background, her femininity, as opposed to be restricted by it, was really something quite interesting politically. Quite interesting.
Talk about Thatcher's political evolution, how she came to hold the views she did, and how much depth there was in terms of the historical context, or was it really to a large extent based upon, as you talk about, her own personal experience?
The historical context and her personal experiences were the same thing in the case of shaping her opinions about foreign policy, because she grew up, I mean, she was born in the wake of the First World War. She lived through the Second World War. These are very, very profound influences on her views of Britain's role in the world. Everyone who experienced the Second World War, a profound anti-appeasement sentiment. She was unique thereafter in the strong view that she took about opposing dictators and taking an absolutely firm stance on communism. So that very much influenced her. So she says in her memoirs, and so you can see the evolution of her economic views. I think a great deal of that came from the nonconformist Methodist tradition in which she was raised. Her father was a Methodist lay preacher. She herself preached on the weekends. She was raised in this tradition, very, very unique, identifiable tradition in Britain of a particular kind of Methodism. And I think the basic values that are associated with Thatcherism, which she defined herself by politically, thrift, hard work, industry, charity, but on a small local scale, not in terms of huge redistribution of wealth from the government. These, I think, in a large way came from that, but then you have a much more sophisticated overlay on top of this. You have to ask, where did that come from? Because she didn't learn about monetarism from counting change behind the grocery counter at her father's store. That was something that came later, that was informed by a lot of thought and reading and study, but particularly by certain intellectual mentors. And I think that the role of Keith Joseph, who was her primary intellectual mentor, is very important here, as well as a few other influences on her who I think are less appreciated. For example, John Hoskins, who was the author of the Stepping Stones Report, which was very, very influential in the Thatcher Revolution. I think that he was a big influence on her intellectually, which is interesting because Hoskins himself, hugely, hugely intelligent man, very well read. He never went to university. And this is true of a lot of people around her, that they either did not have a conventional education or were in some ways outsiders. They were Jewish. They were people who hadn't gone to the right schools. Not a lot of women. She was the only one. But that's an interesting thing about her.
Why was there an appeal to her for those people sort of outside the mainstream?
She was very firmly of the opinion that the standard conservative elite had failed the country, that they were unable to think outside the box, that they were simply too timid, too dogmatic, and they were responsible for the state that Britain found itself in. She wanted people who were really capable of thinking differently. Obviously, there's an emotional sympathy, an undercurrent of sympathy between her and people who felt on the outside, people who didn't feel of the traditional Tory elite. In some cases, I think it's just the way it shook out, that she was able to see that the talent wasn't exactly where you would expect to find it.
Tell us a little bit about the state of the country when Thatcher took over. What was the economic situation, the political situation that Britain faced?
Okay, the first thing that I should say is that when we talk about British decline, we are not talking about absolute decline, we're talking about relative decline. But Britain had slowly but surely been declining since the Second World War, relative to other European powers, to the point where Britain compared to, say, France, Germany, or Japan, that's not a European power, but was very shabby, really plagued by severe labor unrest. The winter of discontent before Margaret Thatcher came to power was a real scar, a real trauma in national imagination. People felt they didn't know whether they could get to work. The labor unions were in control of everything and not working to serve the country's interests, but rather their own narrow sectional interests. People felt very much, I think, from what people have told me, that they did not feel that life was getting better. They did not feel any hope that life was getting better, that they couldn't save, that they had no way of doing anything but just getting by. A brighter future was not really imaginable. People were leaving Britain and coming to the United States if they could. And there was a general feeling that nothing could be done about this but, and this is on both sides of the political spectrum, nothing could be done about this but to manage Britain's decline, that Britain's days were over. This was natural, and the best you could hope for was a technocratic easing of the suffering. And Margaret Thatcher said, she blazed into prominence with the message, no, we can reverse this. we can and we should. And she identified very clearly the source of the decline, which was not imperialism, not post-imperial, not what Britain deserved as a post-imperial power, but socialism. She said it is too much nationalization of the industries or commanding heights of our economy. It is too much government control, too much government intervention. Tax rates are too high. We have been trying to do stuff that should be done by private enterprise, and Britain is full of talent, full of natural resources, full of people who would make this country spectacular again if only we would let them get on with it and get the government off their backs, which is the message that anyone familiar with the time of Ronald Reagan would also recognize, that she was actually saying that even before him. And very much to the surprise of observers, she was able to win the election with this message.
She was able to win the election with that message, and it was a powerfully sounding message at the time. Turning that message into reality proved to be quite a controversial challenge.
To say the least, yeah. Now, this people may not realize that Britain was nearly taken to the brink of civil war during the miners' strike. And the miners' strike was, I would say, the moment that signifies the heart of the conflict of the Thatcher Revolution. This was during 1984 when, finally, the miners pushed too far, and the Thatcher government decided this is it, they can't go any further. The National Union of Miners is tremendously politically powerful, because you have to remember that coal was the source of the energy that ran the country. So when you think of the mine workers, you have to think of them more or less as you would think of OPEC, really. You would have to think of this as if OPEC were a domestic industry, and the government took on OPEC in the middle of the country for a year with the full apparatus of the state, spying on... This wasn't pretty. They infiltrated the mine workers. The police took them on in violent conflicts, and they broke the strike, but it was a very, very painful, protracted, ugly thing, and no one will ever forget it who lived through it. But after that, Britain's labor markets were so much more efficient, and I know that sounds like a technocratic word, but it's incredibly important if you want to be competitive economically, that Britain went from being one of the least desirable places for people to hire labor to one of the most in Europe, which makes a huge difference.
Talk about that connection. How did it go from the miners' strike to the union's labor becoming so much more efficient? What happened? What transpired?
I wonder if I should start with the basics there, which is that because of the hold of the labor unions, companies could not, first, they couldn't hire labor for the price they could afford. So it's quite simple economically, but you have to think about it. If you're a company, do you want to invest in Britain if you know that labor costs so much more than it does in, say, Germany, and that it's unreliable and striking and inefficient? Of course you don't, right? And what she did is she terrified not just the National Union of Mine Workers, but all of the unions. And after that, they all began to say, okay, we just can't function this way. We've lost power. We have to do business. Period. We can't be doing this anymore. We can't be setting these conditions on the price of labor and the conditions under which it works. And for anyone who was in the labor movement, this was devastating. This seemed like a terrible setback for the working man. The problem is the economic model that underlay that assumed that wealth could still be created if no one wanted to hire British workers. And what is increasingly obvious is no, it couldn't. British industries, not just the coal industry, but many others, were simply deteriorating. No one wanted to work with them. No one wanted to buy the products. No one wanted to do trade. And the Soviet trade minister came to Britain prior to Thatcher's rise to power, I think it was 1978. And then the Soviet trade minister and said, we don't want to do business with you. Your goods and your services are unreliable. You never deliver anything on time.
Give us a sense of how the country responded to this, although it unleashed all of this efficiency, as you say, all of this economic progress that would
all
come.
All of this is mixed, yeah, but a lot of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Give us a sense of how the country reacted to that.
Well, we're talking about a big country, right? So there's not one reaction. Parts of the country were, especially in the South, were absolutely thrilled because they got very, very wealthy, and they were very, both ideologically and materially, delighted with this revolution. And parts of the country have still not fully recovered and will never forgive her. And the culture was changed permanently, for sure. A huge pop culture revolution was spawned by the by Thatcherism.
One of the things that's so interesting is that even though she unleashed all of this economic potential and that it had a huge positive impact, that people were still suspicious of her, still angry at her, still less than enamored with her, even after many of her policies were successful.
Yeah, you mean, why is it there's still so many people who think Thatcherism sounds, even it is, who will say negative things about Thatcher even when they themselves are obviously the beneficiaries of her policies?
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting question. I do explore it in the book. I think that there's certainly a lot of anxiety about what she represented as a woman, as someone who broke through a lot of class barriers, that in some ways the message that she gave has not been fully assimilated. And the message was that it is not only economically better to have societies organized on free market principles, it's morally better. And she was fighting the message that socialism was morally good. And a lot of people still believe that, all right, even if Thatcherism made us wealthier, or even if it made a lot of people wealthier, there's still something morally wrong about that, because we shouldn't want that. Or we should want to have the moral goodness of socialism. I think there's a lot of that. And also, Thatcher was an abrasive personality. She rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I mean, she could be utterly charming, utterly charismatic, but she could also just really rub people the wrong way. Her voice, her bearing could be very imperious. And a lot of people remember that there was hardship associated with her policies, especially, you know, if you go to a mining community or a former mining community, they are not capable of looking at the big picture. Well, no, that's not true. Then, of course, they are capable of looking at the big picture, but the wound that their community suffered looms very large in their minds, and it isn't going to be forgiven.
Talk a little bit about her policies of privatization.
Mm-hmm. The thing to start with is the policy of nationalization, which took place after the Second World War and was seen as a reward for people who had suffered so much, who had worked so hard to defeat the Nazis. The idea was, Churchill was defeated at election, and the idea when Clement Attlee took power was that they would build a new Jerusalem in Britain, and would do so by nationalizing the commanding heights of the economies. And when Thatcher took power, these industries were nationalized, and they were not doing well, and slowly she denationalized them with varying degrees of success, rails, telecoms. And I think overall the policy was pretty successful. Was extremely successful, and in some industries more so than others. It's hard to measure, for example, in something like telecoms, whether there would have been a lot of change in the industry anyway. But the difference, from my point of view, between British telecom before denationalization and after was night and day. In some places, I think the denationalization did not go far enough, and Britain was not only still in the business of making cars when during this time it was actually taking on more of the burden of the car industry, just like the United States is now. British Leyland was brought further under British control with more taxpayer money invested, and of course it was a total failure.
I want to talk a little bit about the certainty that Thatcher brought to this, and it really goes to the heart of your title, There Is No Alternative. There's a sense that she never blinked. She had great certitude in what she was doing, and even in the face of some of the kinds of opposition you've touched on, she just kept going full speed ahead.
There is that sense, isn't there? And that's one of the most amazing things that comes through about her when you study the time that she was in office. You look at that and you think, where did that self-confidence come from? Could I conceivably ever have done what she did? And I think, for example, of the Falklands War in particular, but also of the miners' strike, also so many decisions where she kept going in the face of incredible opposition. The first years of her economic policy were nightmarish. They were nightmarish. 4 million unemployed, rioting on the streets, not just rioting the streets, going up in flames, and everyone against her in her own party, in the press. She was called in before Parliament to name two economists who agree with her. She managed to cough up the names of two absolutely dogged loyalists, and on the way back, the ride back, one of her aides said to her, it's a good thing you weren't asked to name three, you know, and yet she pursued the policy. She would not back away. She said there will be no U-turn, because she felt in her heart it was the only alternative. There was no alternative. She felt that, and she was convinced of it, and she had the guts to push it through. Could I have done that? I don't think so.
Where did that confidence come from? Where
it's
did that wellspring
about her.
Evolve?
It's a big mystery. I don't know. I think it's a freak of nature, honestly. I think that some people are just born that way. I think it can be cultivated to an extent, but I don't think normal people are that way, for good or ill.
You touched on something before that I want to come back to, which was this sense of moral, what she perceived as moral clarity, certainly with respect to the evils of socialism. But it seemed to go to the heart of all of her policies, that they seemed to be a moral underpinning that at least she created that gave her some of that backbone we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. She was firmly of the opinion that there was such a thing as right and wrong, and second, that should guide policy, and especially of the opinion that all species of socialism and communism were wrong, morally wrong, not just less efficient ways to organize an economy, but absolutely wrong in the sense that they robbed individuals of their ability to make the myriad choices that you make in a free economy every day, and without being able to make choices, there is no morality, because the essence of morality is freedom of will. And she believes that socialism took away man's capacity to exercise his free will, and free will being obviously, in her view, a gift from God. This was absolutely wicked.
It's interesting that she came to these views without really a profound education in some of the philosophical underpinnings of those ideas. You mentioned in the book, you know, you talk about Hobbes and Rousseau and those competing ideas. These were not things that she had a deep understanding of, and yet they were things that were inculcated into her attitudes in profound ways.
I don't think there's any evidence that she had really deeply thought about Hobbes, but she certainly had deeply thought about Hayek and Friedman and the Old and the New Testament. I don't know how, as a political philosopher, I don't know that she would have stood up to someone like, she didn't have the richness of learning someone like Keith Joseph, but it was also unfair to suggest that she had no familiarity with these ideas. Absolutely unfair. That's really a caricature of her that just doesn't stand up at all. She was a highly intelligent woman. People like to say she wasn't, but that's obviously untrue.
Talk about her relationship with Ronald Reagan.
It was very tender, very, very touching when you look at the letters between them and the way they spoke to each other. It was a really rich, deep friendship. It wasn't just a political, well, in some sense, all there was to the two of them was politics. It was not on the other side, so in some sense it was just a political friendship, but it wasn't just a friendship of expedience. They really, really liked each other and did right from the start. And many people told me, or not many, but a few people told me something that sort of surprised me. It was that she really envied him. She thought, wow, everyone likes him. Same message in effect, but he's able to deliver it in a way that doesn't make people hate him. So there was something I thought touching about that. And I think that, I'm guessing, I don't know quite as much about Ronald Reagan, but I'm guessing that there was a part of him that thought, wow, everyone thinks she's smart. How does she manage to get people to think that? But they found each other necessary that way and useful, and I think they really respected the other's political abilities, and they understood what the other one was going through. There aren't very many people who will understand what that feels like, and they saw in each other ideological allies and people who were tasked with similar responsibilities. That was a really deep friendship.
And was there an understanding among the two of them that within the context of the shared ideas that they had, that they were reflective of deeper changes that were taking place in the world that they were at the forefront of?
Oh, sure, sure. Both of them, I think, were persuaded that the time was at hand to really push back against the Soviet Union, and this despite both of them being advised it can't be done. We're talking, you know, only containment, not rollback. And I think both of them saw themselves as incredibly significant actors, as they were. And both of them were very aware of their responsibility. I don't mean this in a narcissistic sense. Both of them were very aware that the fate of the free world rested on the choices they made.
And who do you think had a greater influence on who?
That's an interesting question. Who do I think had a greater influence on who? Well, I think that Thatcher had a very big influence on Reagan's view of Gorbachev and the relationship he developed with him. Thatcher, in some ways, discovered Gorbachev. She was the first one to really speak to him. She was the one who came back and said, we can do business with him. I think that was very influential on Reagan. I don't think that either of them needed to influence the other when it came to the idea of free markets and rolling back the size of the state. I think they found each other sympathetic precisely because they were both deeply, deeply persuaded of this, but I do think that some of America's privatization policies were influenced by seeing how successful they'd been in Britain. He was incapable of influencing her at certain key junctures. He wanted her to, after the after several significant military victories in the Falklands, Reagan called her and he wanted her to accept a settlement because he was saying to her, you've got your honor back now, and now we just cannot take the risk of destabilizing this region. It could leave it vulnerable to communist adventures. And she just scorched the telephone line saying, you've got to be kidding. We are not accepting a settlement. There is nothing we're going to accept now other than complete victory.
What was the Falklands about for her?
It was about British citizens who didn't want to become Argentines, and it was about aggression and not allowing aggression to go rewarded. It was about British honor. It was about British credibility. It was about many things that sound quite abstract, and you would wonder why they were worth so much blood and treasure, but I think that it was a significant turning point in the Cold War as a signal to the Soviet Union that the West was not a decadent passe power, and that someone like Margaret Thatcher meant it when she said, "We will defend what we think is significant." It was also the right thing to do. And the people on that island did not want to be Argentines; they wanted to be British.
Talk a little bit about Thatcher's later years and the influence that she had after she left office.
Thatcherism was never rolled back. Key figures, the Labour Party said publicly, okay, we're all Thatcherites now. Everyone saw that what she had achieved in Britain had made a dramatic, dramatic difference to Britain's fortunes and Britain's economy. It was emulated around the world. And in every continent, significant Thatcherite reforms were implemented, even if they weren't called Thatcherite reforms. As a senior stateswoman, her influence as a symbol has been huge. Still a polarizing figure, still a controversial figure, but it's very significant that in the run-up to the last presidential election, all of the Republican candidates, or all the aspiring Republican candidates, made this symbolic pilgrimage to see her, even though it's very well known that her mental health is not good anymore. She's had a series of strokes. They're certainly not over there seriously discussing policy with her. They're going to make a ritual pilgrimage to say, I am speaking to the spiritual head of the conservative movement. I must get her blessing. That's what the symbolism of that gesture is. But I think her influence is massively significant, and I think it's going to acquire even more significance with time. Because what I said at the end of the book, which is coming true faster than I expected, is this debate about socialism, it's not over. It hasn't even remotely been resolved. We're still having this debate. We're having this debate very noisily right now about whether economies should be planned or free. And she's the single most important exponent politically of the idea that they should be free. And when I say the most important, I say in terms of making the case in a way that people can now go back and look at and read and think, okay, what is she saying here? What does it mean? And does it apply to this circumstance?
One wonders what she would think of perhaps the excess of free market that has led to some of the problems in the world over the past several years.
Yeah, you remember that cover of Time saying the era of Thatcher is Thatcher mm-hmm. Reagan is dead right in the wake of the financial crash. And there was this idea going around that the economic crisis was the direct consequence of the deregulation of the Thatcher and Reagan era, and it's ahistorical. It doesn't make any sense at all. The kind of complicated financial instruments that we're talking about, the mortgage crisis and Wall Street, they didn't even exist at the time Thatcher was in power. There is no possibility of connecting them to Thatcherite deregulation. In fact, she actually pushed a very stringent banking regulation reform. She was a proponent of stricter banking regulation in certain respects. The kind of deregulation that she did favor, no one is thinking about reversing, and no one is saying was responsible for this in any serious way. For example, the easing of currency controls. No one is saying we need to regulate currency exchange now. That's ridiculous. And it's pretty clear that the Big Bang, which was the big package of reforms to the British banking system, which attracted capital from all over the world, I don't think anyone's looking seriously at that and saying this is a deregulation that led to the crisis on Wall Street or the crisis in the housing market in the United States. It does not make any sense. It can only make sense if you say, well, she promoted a certain kind of greed. She has encouraged people to be greedy, and that's what led to it. But that's ridiculous, frankly. I mean, that's ahistorical. It doesn't make sense. First, she didn't encourage greed. She encouraged people to participate fully in a free market, and she believed that there was nothing wrong with wanting to make the most of one's talents and make money for one's children and one's family. She said, no, there's nothing wrong with that, but she didn't encourage greed. She was, of course, against greed. Everyone's against greed. It's an easy call. So I don't think that there's any real serious case to be made connecting Thatcher to this particular financial.
You talk about the Republican candidates making pilgrimages to see Thatcher. How is she perceived among conservatives and among the Conservative Party today in Britain?
I think everyone wants to capitalize on the idea that there are policies in her, there are politicians in her mold, and I think that right now David Cameron is justifying his policies as Thatcherite policies. Everyone wants to be a successful politician like her. Whether anyone in the Conservative Party in Britain is a politician in her caliber, I kind of doubt. But their politicians in her caliber are very rare, and they don't come around that often.
Claire Berlinski, her book is There Is No Alternative, Why Margaret Thatcher Matters. It's just out in paperback from Basic Books. Claire, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
You're so welcome. It was a pleasure.